Hello, everyone, and welcome to Coast to Cast, a podcast on coastal science, where we meet scientists and ask questions that don't usually appear in published paper. My name is Giovanni Coco, and today I'm here with Ab van Dongeren. Ab van Dongeren is a coastal scientist working at Deltares in beautiful Delft. Hello, Ab. Welcome to Coast to Cast, and thanks for taking the time to join us.
Hi, Giovanni.
Your career has been primarily in the Netherlands. From what I know, you've been at Deltares for quite a while, and you have developed quite an incredible experience in the area of infragravity waves, both from a theoretical perspective, a numerical perspective, and also some incredibly interesting experiments you've been part of. We'll discuss all of this in our chat. But I want to start with our usual question, and that's about COVID. How has it been over the past few years, and how is it going now?
In the Netherlands or with myself?
So, just for you.
For me, I never got COVID. So I was super super cautious, I think. We worked at home, and both my kids are out of the house. They're in student houses in Delft. So they were at a distance. They tested a lot. I think they were the most liable to get it. In the end, they did get it. And I worked from home, and I never got it. So
has it affected your research, your work?
It did, of course, because I think my circle got a little bit smaller. I interacted a lot with the coastal hazards group here at Deltares. So that's a group of about 10, 15 people. But I miss the coffee chats with people that are not that I'm not directly doing projects with. And almost like the first day when we were allowed back in, I was sitting down in the restaurant, and there's a coffee corner. I was just doing some work in one of the booths, and people walked by, and there were two or three opportunities that came by. Not everything turned into projects, but those things don't happen when you're working at home. Few people call you up and say, hey, what about this? It's just, some of it is just happenstance, you know. You just meet people in the hallways, and that's what I miss the most. For my international projects, we were already working online, so I have a couple of projects with the Office of Naval Research and a Naval Research Lab and the USGS, and that continued already, because also, those people are not in the same location. So Zoom was the way to work, and that worked out pretty well. So it didn't affect that part of the research. It's just the circumstantial things and catching up with people. So, but that's all good now again.
Tell us how you started in coastal science and coastal engineering.
Yeah, but first of all, you said you've been at Deltares for quite a while, and I was reminded by our HR department that on Thursday, I'm celebrating my 25th anniversary at Deltares. And boy, do I feel old. All of a sudden, I was like, oh my God, 25 years here. But I've done a lot of different things here at Deltares, and that's the nice thing about how Delft Hydraulics used to be, and also now Deltares. If you take the opportunity, you can do things that the opportunities are there. So, but to start with the how I got started, I was thinking about that apparently, and I wasn't told by my mother until I actually started working at Delft Hydraulics, but apparently I was 5 or 6 years old, and there was a program on TV about Delft Hydraulics and the research station and the labs. And she said, you were very intrigued, and you looked up and you said, I want to work there, when I was five. So, and she kept that with her. She didn't say anything. She didn't egg me on or do anything. And I just, I rolled through high school, and I went into civil engineering and coastal engineering, and then I got an internship at Delft Hydraulics to do my master's thesis, and and then I did my PhD in Delaware, and then I did get the job at Delft Hydraulics 25 years ago, and that's when she told me, she's like, you said this already 25 years ago that you, or no, not 20, it, when you were five, that you were going to work there, and it worked out. So I think I was predestined.
That's a pretty incredible story, really.
Yeah, and true. If I have to believe my mother, so and it's also nice that. Yeah, and it's also nice that she kept it, and she didn't tell me when I was going into civil engineering or coastal engineering that I had said this, because that would maybe bias my choices. But anyway, so yeah, that's how I rolled into it. I think for the science part, I really got started with the internship at Delft Hydraulics. I worked with Huib de Vriend, who was a great mentor. Really helped, showed me what the where we were with the science. I was working on the behavior of tidal inlets, how they react to not even sea level rise at the time. We were most concerned about land subsidence due to gas and salt mining, and all the other changes like closure, partial closure of tidal inlets. So I developed a model for that. What I saw quickly, and I was and was encouraged to find the boundaries of the edges of what we know and what we don't know. And I tell my students this all the time. Pretty quickly, when you start reading the literature, you come up with questions that haven't been answered yet, and that happens very soon. It's surprising. I went to Delft Hydraulics for my internship, thinking I was going to fill in some of the blanks and they know everything already. And within a couple of months, I was at the edge. I was asking questions that they didn't know the answer to. And they're like, well, go ahead, figure it out. So, and that's when I saw kind of the light for science. You know, I see our knowledge is like a big balloon and it's getting bigger and bigger, but also the interface with the unknown gets bigger. So there's always more questions that need to be answered. So that's how I got started. I got the, a really nice thesis, well advised by Huib de Vriend. I got to write a paper about it. So that was a really nice experience. And I started to apply for a PhD in the US, because I read a lot of papers on tidal inlets from US researchers. So I thought, okay, let's give it a try. My wife is American, so that also helped to make a move. And I ended up in Delaware, which was a great experience. It was Ib Svensson was there, Tony Dalrymple, Nobu Kobayashi, Jim Kirby. So that was the group at the time. And
what a group.
Yeah, I worked with. Yeah, and it was in the ascendance. I think it was they there was a lot of funding. There was a lot of energy there. You know, Mick Heller, Tuba Oskan was there. Jim Kaihatu, Dan Cox, Jane McKee Smith. Even she was working from remote, Brad Johnson, and forgetting all kinds of people, I think, but there was a really good body of students that and a really nice atmosphere, a really cooperative atmosphere. So that was a really nice experience. Wrote my thesis there. The professors encouraged us to go to conferences, so we were always there with a large delegation, which was also, you know, a really good learning. Learned a lot from giving talks and interacting with people. And then I went back to Holland. What happened at the time was that Delft Hydraulics had two locations, one in Delft and one kind of the waterways research station out in De Voorst in the northeast. And they closed that one down. And people were supposed to move, but a lot of people didn't move and started their own companies. So there was a lot of opportunity back in the newly formed Delft Hydraulics location in Delft, especially for people with my background on waves. There were only a few people that knew anything about waves, including Marcel van Gent and some other people. But Ad Reniers was there, of course, but that was about it. And there were a lot of projects that needed to be run. So I started in laboratory wave generation, which was not my topic, but just something that came across my way and started working on that. So before I went back to numerical modeling, I did a lot in laboratory wave generation, laboratory experiments, and then numerical modeling and earth observation and you name it, anything is possible. So that's how I got started. And that's how I started rolling.
Tell us, how do you balance your personal life and work life, and has it changed through the years?
Yeah, it has changed through the years. I think in the beginning it was easier without smartphones. So your work day is over, and we didn't have laptops, so you just left your work material at home necessarily, or at work, and then went home. Then the smartphones came and the laptops, and I recognized that I kept working and checking my emails all through the weekend, and that was really not good for me. I really had to take a distance. You know, Friday night stuff would come in and I would mull over it all weekend, and because but I couldn't solve it without help on Monday. So there was no point in reading something on Friday that you can't solve. So what I ended up doing was really shutting down my laptop, and I got two mobiles. So I turn off my my work mobile, even though I could have gotten a dual SIM. I know I'm too weak to not turn off the other SIM. So now I physically turn off my work phone, and that's it. Then I'm reachable for some people on my personal phone if they really need to, but I stay away from the work emails and WhatsApps and all the messages. So
That's
that's how I
fantastic.
try to do that. Yeah.
I'm envious. Tell us about your interests out of work.
Out of work. Yeah, I started cycling in the COVID times. So I'm cycling quite a lot now, and it was interesting because I was quite late to it, and friends of mine were we were going to go to southern France to somebody has a house there, and they said, well, we're going to go cycling and you're the only one without a bicycle, so you should go get a bicycle. This was like 2 months before the trip. I said, all right. So I went to the store and they said, no, we have no road bicycles anymore, no race bicycles, because everybody had bought one already. So in the end, I did find one, and I started training, because it's not quite the Pyrenees, but it was like the foothills of the Pyrenees that we were gonna try to conquer. So that was my goal, to get up some stamina to go up those hills. So we did do it. I did do it. So and I kept going ever since. Also in the winter, winters are terrible here. So lots of rain and wind. So I got one of these indoor trainers. You know, you take off the back wheel of your race bike and you put it on this dynamo, and there's movies that you can play that somebody has recorded, like you ride through Bologna or you ride through Florence or somewhere in Spain, and it you just ride on the road, and it's really nice to just ride for an hour and to go up hills and go through Tuscany. So then you it feels like spring or summer again. So that's what I do. Cycling, and I cook a lot. So I cook Italian food, but my passion is Greek food. So I learned to eat Greek food in Baltimore, of all places, and not the big meals, but I cook the mezze, so the appetizers, which can be quite filling, almost like tapas, basically in Spain,
Okay.
and learn to cook that, and learn how to make stuffed crepe leaves and other dishes. So every once in a while I take 2 days to make like seven or eight dishes. So especially on Christmas time or holiday time, it's
I'll
quite
invite
relaxing.
myself. I'll invite
Yeah,
myself
yeah, yeah.
next time I
I'll when
visit.
you come, I'll cook for you. It's quite relaxing because you have to make these dishes well in advance. You know, you. I'm not light on the garlic, so the garlic has to permeate through the dish. So it's best to make things like a day before, and just refrigerate it. So you can take your time making the dish, and then I make like three a day, and go to the store back and forth. And we have a nice Turkish delicatessen store, which has the feta and olives and grape leaves and everything. So
Deal
yeah,
done.
it's quite relaxing. What's that?
Deal done.
Yeah, deal done. Yep.
Let's go
So
back
that's what
to
I do.
science or maybe to engineering. In fact, do you think of yourself as a scientist or as an engineer? And what's the difference for you?
Yeah, I saw that question, and that was, I think, the hardest question that I don't quite know the answer to. I don't feel like I'm a super fundamental scientist. You know, But I'm also not an engineer because I'm not designing coastal structures or any of that. What I'm involved in is well, on the numerical modeling side, tinkering, putting things together, and making things that work sort of and that are useful. But yeah, they're not. Well, I would say it's science. We're trying to solve some scientific problems, but we also want to make it applicable to for contractors and engineers to use. So, and I think that's why I'm at Deltares, because we're actually right on that bridge between consultants being the consultancy and the science. So I get that question asked also at Deltares. There's different career tracks, and they say, are you an advisor, as they say it here, which is like a consultant, or are you in the coastal science? And I said, well, I can't choose. So the head of my department said, no, you have to choose. And I said, well, I'm right in the middle. He said, yeah, you're kind of a model Deltarian in that way to be able to do both. And I said, yeah, but you're still making people choose between two tracks. So I've always avoided making a clear choice there, because I kind of do both.
What could we do to improve our community?
I think, yeah, that was also a really good question. And I was thinking back to 20, 30 years ago, and I think it has improved a lot already. There's a lot more interaction between different disciplines, between different groups. On the national level here in the Netherlands, we have the NCK consortium or group, the Netherlands Center for Coastal Research. It used to be that the universities and different groups were kind of doing their own thing without interacting, almost competing almost. But now there's a lot more interaction with earth sciences and earth observation and coastal engineering. And I see that also on the international front, there's much more interest in social science. So I think that's where it's going, and that's where it still needs to go, is to include also those other disciplines. I think the hard sciences, it's easiest there, like geophysics, geomorphology, to include that in coastal engineering. But what I'm seeing lately is that we can propose all kinds of solutions, but they also have to land and be accepted by local populations and governments. So social inclusion, social inclusiveness, things more of the domain of the social sciences also need to be addressed, and we're not going to be the experts on it as the beta scientists, but we need to be aware of it, that that there's humans involved, and that proposals for a hard coastal defense or a mangrove restoration, they also need to be accepted by local population, and people need to be convinced or have that this would work. So there needs to be a lot of more interaction with population, and there's people that are experts in that, on how to do that. So I think we need to be aware of that as well.
Can you explain one of the topics of research that you're really passionate about?
Well, that would be infragravity waves that you mentioned before. I started on that with Ib Svensson back in what was it, 92. And what an infragravity wave is that you don't typically see an infragravity wave, but they're hidden underneath the waves that you do see, the sea swell waves. So waves typically come in sets. Surfers know this, that there's a bunch of high waves, a bunch of lower waves, and then there's a bunch of higher waves. So those are wave groups. And these wave groups, when the waves are high, they kind of depress the mean surface of the water level, the mean water level, quite a little bit. And that depression travels with that wave group. That in itself is a wave, because it comes up when the waves are low and it goes down when the waves are high. It travels with the wave groups, and they're quite small. It's millimeters in the deeper ocean, but they travel with these wave groups. But it starts to get interesting when the bottom, the depth starts to change. So near the coast, the waves start to shoal, and the waves start to break, and they start to transfer energy to these infragravity waves, especially during storm conditions. And then they can become quite large. Yeah? They can become several tens of centimeters. And I think Germer Husing measured one of Trucvair, which was, I think, a meter and a half of infragravity wave. So they can become quite large. And so that there's an interest there. We understood later, after I finished my PhD, that they severely affect the dune erosion process. So that was very important for the Dutch context because most of our coast, or a large part of our coast, is protected by dunes. So we understood better how the dune erosion process takes place, and we put that into the X-Beach model as well. But all the time I was working on this, I was when I went to conferences, I was in the long wave sessions with people who were working on tsunamis, which are also long waves but have a totally different nature. So we were kind of a small group. But then after the year 2000, it kind of took off. We understood better how it worked. We saw them clearly on coral reefs. I worked with Ryan Lowe at the University of Western Australia. And it was a great interaction because he was wondering if the motions that he saw were infragravity waves and whether or not we could model them. So he handed us his data set and we put a student on it. And lo and behold, she could reproduce that with X-Beach. And then we started to investigate the processes by which infragravity waves are generated on coral reefs or fringing reefs, which are much more clear and spatially separated than on sandy coast. So it's actually much more clear a case of how infragravity waves are generated. And you can actually see them when you when you're standing in the lagoon behind a fringing reef. You can, hey, if you stand there for a couple of minutes, then you see the water level go up and down. And so the periods of these infragravity waves are typically 25 seconds, 2 minutes. So if you wait a little while, you can see like this kind of mini tide go up and down. And those are the infragravity waves. And then the lagoon breathes with the wave groups. So we saw them on coral reefs. We had a great session in France. It came out that people had seen them everywhere. They started to recognize infragravity waves in the hum of seismographs in the deep ocean. And so waves break on the beach and they create this hum, which was unexplained. Also in they pry loose the ice from ice caps. So there's all kinds of applications, including ship motions for very large carriers, which are moored offshore. They're very sensitive to these longer period waves. So that was an industry application also of our knowledge of infragravity waves.
Definitely a fascinating topic.
Very fascinating topic.
Still working on infragravity waves?
Still, we're still improving our X-Beach model and turning it more into infragravity wave driven run-up and flooding. So I've kind of moved on shore. So from the near shore, we're now working more on flooding processes, working on a project for the Naval Research Lab on flooding of small islands and how that's driven by infragravity waves. So try to operationalize that. So I'm still in that business.
We briefly mentioned the laboratory experiments. Can you tell us about one of the wildest experiments you've been part of?
Yeah, that there's one clear one. We were asked to do a study about slamming of waves on a vertical wall. So, but we needed to make a really high wave relatively, which we couldn't make in the flume. So what we did is we made a chirp. So a chirp is when the wave maker makes a short wave and the period of the wave maker increases gradually. So then there's the short waves are being propagated and they get longer and longer and longer. And from dispersion theory, you know that the longer waves will start to overtake the shortest waves. So if you time it perfectly, the waves just pile up and they rise up and then you get this slamming. And it was a little bit of a trick to it because we couldn't use linear wave theory because then it kind of all flattened out like a souffle. So we had to do some tricks. But I think we got 2 weeks of tank time to get this right. And I think on day two, we got it right. I worked with a colleague, Bas Hofland, on this. So after 2 days, we could have said, we're done, but we didn't. We just we stayed in the lab, and we made all kinds of investigations about the timing and the placement relative of to the wall of this of this breaking wave. And so we had a fun time just playing with it, because we already had the result. So that code of how to make the chirp was lingering on my PC for a long time. And when it came time to open the new Delta flume, one of my colleagues, and not myself actually, but one of my colleagues pulled that out and wanted to make this chirp as a demonstration wave during the opening. And there's video of that. There's a YouTube video, because they kind of cranked the amplitude a little bit too high, because the waves were piling up and they broke right where there was a platform with two government ministers and other dignitaries. And they got flooded. So the ministers kept a good face on it, because I know they're trained to do that. Because of social media, they can be angry, but I don't think they were very amused. It wasn't on purpose that we did this. It just turned out that way. But that shows you the power of the waves. And the wave broke and got a lot of people wet. So that was a nice laboratory experiment, because things worked and we made something new and we could apply it later. So we learned a lot from it.
Tell us about the strangest thing you've seen at the beach.
Yeah, I had to think about that. I'll go back a little bit. When I was a kid, I stood on the beach and I saw waves coming towards me and break. That's not unusual, but I was wondering, how would that be on the other side? Like, because I had no idea where waves come from. And I was like, so I knew England was on the other side of our beach. And I was like, are the waves traveling away from England? How did that look like? I must have been 10 or something, because I was like, I've never seen anything, any vacation or any TV show where there is a wave that is traveling away from the beach. So, and then, so maybe that also sparked my interest in waves, like where did they come from? And I really had no idea that they were caused by the wind and there was refraction, nothing. So that puzzled me. But then I've never seen waves travel away from the beach. But during a vacation in Delaware on Rehoboth Beach, I did see waves traveling perpendicular to the beach, and that was really strange. It must have been a tide and a wave phenomenon, but the waves were pretty high, traveling along the beach and not really refracting towards the beach. There was no real surf zone to speak of. And I didn't record it, and maybe other people have seen it more commonly, but I'd never seen it, and I've never seen it since. So that was, I think, the strangest thing I've seen on the coast, I would say.
Definitely qualifies as strange.
Yeah.
Let's go back to science. What's your take on machine learning?
Machine learning. We've used some of these techniques, and what I'm interested in is conditions that are extreme, that haven't been seen yet, or situations that haven't existed yet, maybe like a land reclamation or a port extension. And I hear a lot of buzz about machine learning and data-driven models, but where's the data that I'm always wondering, what data can I use to drive a machine learning technique to tell me something about these extreme conditions? So the way we have solved it is to numerically generate this data with models like XSPeech, and then running the model. A student of mine, Stuart Pearson, did this 500,000 times, generating output and using that as data to make a Bayesian estimator of wave attack on reef environments called Beware. So, but the data is very sparse. So machine learning techniques can be very powerful. What I'm wondering about is the data that would drive it for the applications that I'm interested in, other than numerical data.
Can you predict a major advance to happen in coastal science over the next 50 years? In which area will be better at?
50 years.
Oh, you can choose the horizon.
Yeah, no. So, I think it would be the usual. I don't think I can see further than 5 or 10 years. When I was thinking about this, I was thinking about a project I did with a student in 2002 or 2003 or something, so about 20 years ago. And we modeled the infragravity waves in Saldanha Bay in South Africa, which was quite a big bay, maybe 3 by 5 kilometers top of my head. And it was almost impossible to run that on a PC. It took, the PC was cranking and we only ran it for a short time. So that was a little bit too far, too much for that time. I think now we would laugh about an application like that. It's something we do in an afternoon. So that computer power, that's gonna keep going. We're gonna do it in the cloud. We're gonna do it on GPUs, graphical processor units. Right now, a colleague of mine is running overland flood models for the entire south coast and east coast of the United States. So we're going to go to continental scale. It's going to go really. I think there's going to be a step change in computational powers. So in 50 years, I don't know, we can do the whole world and run it in real time. Have a digital twin of the world. We need to feed it with data, and that data is also coming. So if you look at ISAT-2, we're going to get bathymetries and topographies that are accurate enough to do these flood calculations. So there's going to be more data that we can shake a stick at. So that's going to be the bottleneck, is how do you get this data into a computer model? We have to interpolate. So. I don't think that's 50 years. I think that's 5 or 10 years. I can't look further than that. So who knows?
Yeah, 50 years.
Hopefully I'm still alive. But I think anything we predict for 50 years is going to go much faster. We're going to be there sooner.
Very likely. Best or worst advice you ever received in your career?
Yeah, a couple of things. One of the best things was an older colleague who recognized that I finished the project, and there was a result, and I just moved on to the next thing, you know, one after the other. And he's like, "Op, you need to celebrate these things, not like with cake and drinks or something, but just take your time and just reflect on what happened." And recognize it. So I've been trying to do that. So that was a really nice little piece of advice. Celebrate your achievements, not to not to be super proud or something, but just to recognize that the job was done and results were made, and before you move on to the next thing. So that was really nice advice. Other good advice was from a friend of my father's, who, when I was wondering about what to do for my, what study to take, I was thinking about informatics or civil engineering. And I said, well, because computers are the future. He's like, well, you can always get back into computers. So much better to learn to do a topic like civil engineering or coastal engineering, and then move on to informatics and just do the pure informatics. So I don't know what route I would have taken if I'd gone into information technology, but I never regretted that advice. That was really good. It was quite the study for me. So
do you have a bad advice?
Bad advice? I think somebody, when the infragravity waves were at a low point in attention, somebody told me to get out of it. But I didn't, because that's what I knew what to do. I stuck with it, and then it took off. So it's bad advice I didn't take. So I didn't get out of infragravity waves. This is the mid-90s. So
very good. Okay, so we're approaching the end of the podcast. Let's go with some very quick questions. One is about music. What's your favorite band, type of music, or composer?
I just go back and forth on Spotify. So sometimes I have times where I play 70s soul, so playlists. Jim Kaihatu got me into Americana, so I'm still playing that 20 years later. Wilco and Uncle Tupelo. There could be years where I don't play it, but now I'm playing California Stars again, and I'm back into those old albums. So if I have to pick a band, that would be Wilco. And types of music can vary. So, yeah.
What's your favorite dish, or do you have a signature dish?
Signature dish that I make, that would be stuffed grape leaves. Yeah.
Latest book you read?
The latest book I read, The Hero's Walk, I think it's called. It's an English hiker who retraced Garibaldi's march from Rome to Ravenna. I read it because we were going to go on a vacation to Ravenna, but well, spoiler alert, he never reaches Ravenna. He ends up on a beach just south of Ravenna and takes a boat and then comes to what is now called Porto Garibaldi, but not at the time, of course, where we also did some research with Paolo Ciavola, and he nearly gets apprehended by the Austrians and then escapes again to La Spezia, I think. So somehow he escapes. But the book is about walking through central Italy and basically the difficulties of traffic and brambles and finding a place to sleep. And then always reflecting on how Garibaldi did that with all these men and all these donkeys and all this stuff and the cannons and everything that he had to haul with him back in 1850 or something. So that was a really nice book. I don't think I'm going to walk that route. It's quite impossible. So,
what about your favorite movie?
Favorite movie? Yeah, that would be Goodfellas. I've watched that many times. So, and it always comes back. The memes come back. There's now in Holland, there's a scandal about these entrepreneurs that scammed the government for face masks back in the 2020, and it all comes out. And there's always tapes, so there's audio tapes of their conversations, and they said something like, when the money comes in, don't buy any new clothes, don't buy new cars, don't buy new houses. And I read that or I heard that clip, and I was like, that's a quote from Goodfellas, and that came out later. So, you know, they watched Goodfellas and they used that clip. You know, Robert De Niro says that to his when they do the Lufthansa heist. They said, don't buy any of this stuff. And then there's the one guy who gets a fur coat for his wife and gets thrown out of the bar. So it's a great movie. And it's just so, yeah, almost true to life and applicable. So I keep rewatching that movie. So great acting.
Okay, this was a great chat. Thanks a lot, App, for taking the time to speak with us. And thanks
to
all
welcome.
Our... Yeah. And thanks to all our listeners, and we hope to see you at the next episode. Bye.
Bye-bye.